Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of How We Got On at the Portland Playhouse, Wednesday through Sundays until October 25th. Directed by Jen Rowe, How We Got On is the story of three teenagers in the suburbs of the Midwest who dream of fame in the golden age of hip-hop in the late 80s. That's How We Got On, Wednesdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. through October 25th at the Portland Playhouse, 602 Northeast Prescott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hip-hopping is the thing that's in. It's where the Stone Cold Nitro party begins. So listen, party people with the ear to the street, the college professor and the social elite, to the fly young guys and the pretty girl. IT is going to tell you about the hip-hop world. Hip-hopping is a way of life.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, a series sponsored by Northwest Film Center. October 2nd through November 5th are the dates. While cinema provides entertainment and escape for many committed filmmakers and viewers, it's a vital medium of engagement and a powerful tool for social action. Films in the series include 50 Feet from Syria, Dreamcatcher, No Land's Song, and We Come as Friends. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film from October 2nd to November 5th at the Northwest Film Center in the Whitzel Auditorium of the Portland Art Museum, located at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue here in Portland. More information about films and screening times can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program featuring interviews with authors of fiction and nonfiction. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kranz. Our guest is international best-selling author Elizabeth Gilbert, with us to share her new book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, published by Riverhead Books. Elizabeth Gilbert is a versatile and creatively boundless author of works of fiction, nonfiction, short stories, a cookbook, and memoirs, including the global phenomenon Eat, Pray, Love. In her latest offering, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, it might appear that Elizabeth Gilbert has branched into self-help books as well, though in the view of the author and this reader, it's more of an exploration of creativity by someone who sincerely enjoys thinking and talking about the subject. However, it is inspirational. She urges the reader to do whatever brings you to life, create whatever causes a revolution in your heart. Big Magic is written in Elizabeth Gilbert's down-to-earth, very funny, wordsmithery, and offers much useful and liberating information for even the practicing and professional artist. Personal anecdotes from her writing career are especially interesting, and her insights on the nature of creative ideas and artistic genius are revelatory, if not revolutionary. On the phone from San Francisco, welcome Elizabeth Gilbert.
Hi, Leanne. How are you? What a very generous and lovely introduction that was. Oh. I was like, I want to meet that person.
Well, thank you. I want to meet you too.
Oh, cool.
This is almost as cool. So thanks for taking time out of your book tour to be with us this morning.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So I want to hear in your words, how would you describe Big Magic?
You're going to laugh because of what you just said in your introduction, but I'm just going to go ahead and call it a self-help book, which is, I think, you know, what anybody who's concerned about their literary legacy would call their work. You know, I have spent years out in public traveling around the world talking, and invariably, when it comes time for the question and answer period of the evening, people have questions and anxieties and obstacles and desires surrounding the question of creativity. And it was really interesting for me over the years to learn that when you talk to people who have a desire to explore their creativity, but they're not actually doing it, or they're blocked for some reason, or they're having some sort of an obstacle around it, when you ask them, when I ask them why they aren't doing the work, they usually have a pretty articulate, laid out, rational list of reasons mm-hmm. as to why they're not doing it. But if you start to pick apart those reasons, it always looks to me like some version of fear. There's some kind of a fear at the bottom of it. And fear, of course, is a many-faced God that shows up in many disguises. It can show up as perfectionism. It can show up as supreme competitiveness. It can show up as insecurity. It can show up as a general sense of lack, you know, living in a world where you feel like you just don't have enough of anything to be able mm-hmm. to be creative. You don't have enough time. You don't have enough money. You don't have the right kind of context. You don't live in the right city. You know, all of those sorts of things are just various versions of fear. And after encountering that for so many years, I thought, maybe I just need to sit down and really efficiently write down all my feelings about this so that I can maybe put it out there and actually maybe help some people get through that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that if you can make peace with fear, so to speak, know that it's part of any creative endeavor, that if you move down that path, you encounter magic in that sort of life pursuit. Can you talk a little bit about how magic shows up in the creative life?
Yeah, it's you know, it's funny because we live in a society where we've really fetishized the idea of fearlessness, and I think everybody is aspiring for fearlessness, and people are always teaching you how to be fearless, and we have this kind of extreme sports, really aggressive kind of macho language that we use around fear, like we're going to kick it in the butt, punch it in the face, and show it who's boss. And that, to me, just sounds like more fear. there seems to be a kind of hyper-anxiety behind that. And yeah. For me, my path to creativity has not been about renouncing or fighting or defeating fear. It's been about learning with a weird kind of affection to walk next to my fear all the time. Because I've realized that fear and creativity are essentially conjoined twins. They're always going to be linked to each other because creativity demands of you that you constantly enter into realms with uncertain outcome. And your fear, by its very evolutionary nature, hates and distrusts any realm that has an uncertain outcome. Mm-hmm. And your fear is certain that anything you do that it doesn't know how it's going to end is going to end in your bloody death, which is why it's so weirdly terrifying to even do such a simple thing as sit down and write a poem. There's some part of you that thinks you're going to die from it. It's really irrational, but it's how the human software functions. And so for me, I've just learned to kind of make friends with that really panicky voice within me and to talk to it in an affectionate way and just explain to it what I'm doing and say, I understand that you're just trying to protect me, but really it's just a novel. No one's going to die. And creativity and I are going to go on this adventure, and you're welcome to come along with us because I know you will. And so I'm constantly living inside my fear and with my fear. And that is where the big magic happens, because once you can safely kind of walk down a path side by side and hand in hand with fear, you can go anywhere and you can do absolutely anything. And that's where the exciting part begins. And the big magic, what I call big magic, is the unexpected, sometimes, you know, completely unanticipated wild surprises that you can find on that path. So as you're laboring along and as you're feeling tremulous and as you're feeling like you can't do this and as you're wondering if it's going to fail and as you're anticipating all the criticism and rejection that's going to come at the end of it, then you have those moments where you brush up against something really, I can only use the word mystical, and suddenly you're making this thing anyway. You know, you've gone past all your rational fear and you're in the realm of pure creativity, and it's as if there's some sort of force assisting you. There's some work that wants to be made, and you transcend yourself. You reach the end of yourself and you enter into something else, something that's really what I feel like the very best way to possibly spend your time. You're engaged with the mysteries of inspiration, and the only way to do that is to allow yourself to be terrified.
I hope you don't mind me asking a deep spiritual question so early in the interview. But I was wondering, the creativity, the force that you talk about throughout your book, Big Magic, how does that relate to the big C, the big creator, that creative force of the universe? In your mind, is it one and the same?
It's our way of participating in that, mm-hmm. and that I just capitalized the T. You know, if you're a God person, then you can call it God. If you're not a God person, you can call it the universe. Mm-hmm. you know, one way or another, whatever you want to call it, it's pretty obvious to anybody who's paying attention and looking around that we live in a world and a universe that is unfolding, that is in creation as we speak, that we don't live in a static state universe. It's not as though, as the old biblical story says, you know, that the universe was created in 7 days and then it was done. You know, this thing is happening. This thing is happening around us. And one moment to another, it's unfolding and changing and transforming. And so I feel like the amazing part about being a human being and having awareness of your own awareness and being part of that system is that you can choose to participate within it. You can choose to look at the world and say, the universe is looking for co-collaborators. Right? The universe is looking for co-creators. This is a story that's unfolding, and I want to be part of it. It's unfolding. I don't just want to be a witness. I don't just want to be a passive bystander as life happens to me. I don't just want to be a consumer. I want to be part of this story of things being made. And for that to happen, I have to feel like I have what the great British poet David White calls the arrogance of belonging. It's a kind of supreme, and I would say spiritual entitlement that lets you think, I'm not here by accident. It's not, whatever's going on here, it isn't random. I'm related to all that has come before me. I'm related to all that will come after me. And while I'm here for my short, weird, freaky life, I want to put a handprint on the world as a way of contributing to its evolution. And that's what creativity is. That's what our ancestors did. That's what your relatives did whenever they altered their environment. That's what we do whenever we sit down for no particular rational reason and say, I want to take nothing and make something out of it. That's creation. And you can call it creation with a small c or creation with a large c, but one way or another, it's you saying, I am part of all that is unfolding around me. And I think that's the most engaging and interesting possible way to look at your life and to look at the universe.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. Our guest today is author Elizabeth Gilbert, talking about her new book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. Elizabeth, you speak of creativity as a human birthright, as the hallmark of our species, and yet so many modern humans are disconnected from that part of themselves. And even those who are connected and living a creative life have some sort of destructive ideas sometimes about what it means to engage with creativity. For example, the myth, the cliche of the tormented artist. Do you mind talking about that a little bit? And you also offer a different way to think about that.
Yeah, you know, the tormented artist is a terrible combination of arrogance and insecurity. It's kind of like the worst of human, you know, of sort of the human way of operating, where on one hand you think you're the most important thing in the entire world, and on the other hand you think you're a worm, you know. And so people who are engaged with the icon of the tormented artist are constantly swinging in their work between grandiosity and self-hatred, which is just another kind of grandiosity. and they're moving between the agony and the ecstasy, essentially, right? And that's an incredibly exhausting way to live, and it's not a very generative way to live. And I think it's a really macho way to approach your work. I think it's got weird undertones of S&M in a strange way, where you're constantly moving between being like the master of the universe and being the slave of the universe, between sort of, it's all about kind of dominance, you know, like who's in charge of who here, so that the relationship that kind of artist has with their creativity is really bloody. And it's really male to me, and it feels to me very recent. It feels like this is a kind of post-Enlightenment German romantic approach to creativity and to the world. And I don't like it, and I've never been attracted to it, and it's never worked for me. And I'm not romantically interested or even fascinated with those kind of people because I just, all I see is some sort of weird battle that a person is having against themselves, where I feel like the much more interesting way to engage with this work is to think that you are neither the master of the universe nor a worm crawling underneath the foot of your own despair. You're actually something that's much more plain and also much more interesting to me, which is you're a worker. You know, you're like a plow mule. You're this strange combination of humility and openness, where you're willing to just sort of steadfastly show up for your work every single day with a kind of humility and curiosity. I think what's missing for me in the grandiosity of the tormented artist is just a sense of very simple curiosity, you know, that says, I find this world to be a very interesting place. I want to engage with it. How can I do that today? What's my part of this? What am I in control of? What am I not in control of? And how can I operate with this so that instead of feeling like I'm at war with it, I feel like I'm at partnership with it? I think that's how people made art for most of history. And somehow we've fallen into this place now in our society where we feel like creativity only belongs to the professional, the tormented, the trained, the special. And for me, that's such a violation of the essential law of being a human being. We're the creative ape. We all have entitlement to this. This isn't something that only a few people are allowed to do. It's something that all of us are allowed to do. And I had a conversation recently with a very elite New York interviewer who said, aren't you afraid that your book is just going to encourage more people to make more bad art?
Mm.
And I was like, first of all, you are a 100% jerk for even thinking that way. And two, my concern with the world is not that the world has too much bad art in it. My concern is that the world doesn't have enough art in it, and that far too many people, millions of people, have been led down this path where they believe that they are not creative, that they are not allowed to express their curiosity, that they are not allowed to leave a handprint on the world. And that's the problem I've got. And I'm not even sure that the world is full of bad art. I think the world, you know, whatever's out there that's being made by somebody is sort of intrinsically interesting, whether or not it appeals to my taste. It's still fascinating to watch people make things, and I just want to see more people doing it.
Mm-hmm. Another artistic myth that you challenge in your book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, is that of the artistic genius. That there are, as you mentioned, there are those few truly gifted people among us who, quote, are geniuses. But you think there might be another way to think about that as well.
Yeah, and what I'm referring to when I talk about genius in my book is actually a very, very, very old, very ancient way of thinking about it. The Greeks and the Romans had a sense of the word genius, but they didn't see it this way. They didn't say that this very talented person making art is a genius. They saw it as this very talented person making art has a genius. And they thought of a genius as a kind of extra body, you know, sort of out of your body, mystical sort of spirit that lived in the home of a person who was creative and worked with that person in very unpredictable ways, sometimes helping them, sometimes not helping them so much. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's ever engaged with creativity knows that feeling, right? Like some days that little spirit is there helping you, and some days it isn't, you know? And there's a great sort of ego relief, I think, that can be found in looking at creativity that way, in saying, this isn't only coming from me. This is me in interaction with forces of inspiration that are very mysterious, that seem to come in and out of me from other places. Some days I'm going to have it, some days I'm not going to have it. It's not all on me. You know, so the idea of calling somebody a genius puts an enormous amount of pressure on the very fragile human ego, where that person now becomes somebody who can take 100% credit for everything great that they do and 100% blame for every failure. And I think that's too heavy a responsibility to put on the fragile human psyche. And I kind of like this older idea that says, like, hey, we're just monkeys fiddling around with forces that sometimes work with us and sometimes don't. And your part of the contract is to continue to show up in the workspace and do the work some days when it's going really well and other days when it's not, you know? And your steadfastness is what you bring to that contract, as well as your open-heartedness, your open-mindedness, your curiosity and your wonder. That's your piece of it. The rest of it's not really up to you. And you know, I've had moments where I'm writing and it's not going well, and it's discouraging, and I will actually just literally say out loud to the universe, like, you guys, I never promised you I would be a great writer. I just said I would be a writer. I'm here doing my job. If you want me to make this book better, then somebody else is going to have to show up in this room. But in the meantime, I'm going to keep doing it, because that's my contract with creativity, is that I'll do the very best I can, and the rest of it's not up to me.
I'm so curious how you, during the global wave of your memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, that unexpected success, how did you keep your creativity flowing and your ego in check during that ride?
Well, it was quite a ride. You know, I had some real advantages at that moment in my life to help me not lose my mind, foremost of which was that Eat, Pray, Love wasn't my first book. It was my fourth book. I think had it been my first book, and there are people who have that tremendous kind of success on their first endeavor, I think that would have been a lot harder because you don't... What I know, after being somebody who had written four books, I know how to do the work steadfastly, regardless of the outcome. You know, so I know that it's okay and that I will survive if I write a book and only 3,000 people buy it, as happened with my very first book. I know that I can stick that landing and that that's okay and that I enjoy the process enough that it's not really that consequential. I would, of course, much prefer that all the books were huge bestsellers, but experience had taught me that most of them are not going to be. And so when I looked at what was going on with the tsunami around Eat, Pray, Love, and people would come up to me and they would ask me, how in the world are you ever going to top this? I had the sort of perspective at that point in my life, and I was also in my late 30s by then. I wasn't a kid anymore. Mm-hmm. I had gone through my kind of personal crises already in my 20s, and I'd been through a lot. I'd been through enough that I could answer that question very sanely and very soberly. So when somebody said to me, as they often did, how in the world are you ever going to top this? My answer was, I can't. Obviously. I mean, this is not something that can be topped. This thing is a really freakish phenomenon. And then their next question would be, well, what are you going to do next? And I would say, I'm going to just keep writing books because that's what I'm here to do. And that's what I did before anybody heard of me. And that's what I'm going to keep doing after people have heard of me. And I don't hate myself enough to set myself up in some sort of an impossible war where I, in order to feel like I have worth and that I matter and that my work has consequence and that my life has meaning, I have to believe that I have to outdo myself every single time I create. And so the only way I can judge myself is by units sold or what the critics say or, you know, how successful a project was in the world, right? So if I'm going to do that, I'm doomed. Because there's no way I can write another book that's going to sell 10 million copies. It's not going to happen. But I can write another book, and I can enjoy the strangeness and the mystery of that process just as much as I've always enjoyed it, and I can put it out into the world with the same sense of, well, this is the best I've got. You guys like it? And sometimes they will, and sometimes they won't, you know? But my God, I'm not going to compete against myself by those measures, because that's asking for a life of suffering, and my commitment to not being a martyr artist is that I will not go out of my way to suffer. So I'm not going to set myself up for anything that's going to make me, you know, experience more pain than I have to in the world, because I'm just not into that.
That self-love you speak of is like the antithesis of the ego. You know, it's a grounding principle, I think, for all human endeavors.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, self-love, my God, that is such a hard, it's such a hard assignment for anybody, because, you know, we know ourselves so well and we're so disappointing to ourselves most of the time, and we wish we were better people and we wish we were different people, and there's, you know, we certainly live in a society where self-hatred is a terrible condition that so many people suffer from. And, you know, for me, even I, after years of spiritual practice and working on this, I even have trouble with the word self-love. Like, there's a part of me that flinches, like, I don't know if I can do that. And so I've even dialed down that expectation, and I've changed the word love to affection, just this kind of, because I think affection has this kind of like, oh, you big dummy.
Yeah, forgiving. Yeah.
Tone behind it, where you can just look at yourself and be like, I am so flawed and I am so imperfect and I'm okay anyway. And, you know, day after day, my attitude toward myself is kind of like, we're stuck with each other, me and myself. And I don't know why we're here. And I don't know why I was given this life. And I don't know why I was given this head full of insanity. But, you know, apparently I was. And apparently it's my stewardship to be able to walk through life as the person that I was sent here to be for some reason. And she and I have come this far together. I'm not going to roll her under the bus now. And that's self-affection, I think, more than it is self-love. It's just this sort of, you know, this kind of practice of expressing a certain kindness and empathy and fondness toward the central human dilemma of having to cope with yourself, which is not always easy, but but it certainly doesn't do anybody any good for me to practice self-hatred. I can't see that I've ever benefited anybody by wallowing in that. Mm-hmm. So this seems to be the more sane alternative.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. Our guest is author Elizabeth Gilbert, talking about her brand new book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. Elizabeth, I wanted to touch on the podcast that you started in tandem to the release of this book. It's mm-hmm. called Magic Lessons with Elizabeth Gilbert. And you said that you weren't, after writing the book, Big Magic, you weren't quite finished thinking and talking about the subject, and you wanted to engage with real people. And I noticed that the six real humans that you talked with on the podcast were women. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you feel that that women have particular barriers to their creativity, and what sort of issues do women face, and what advice do you offer them?
Yeah, first of all, I would love nothing more than to have a dude come on Big Magic and talk about his creative obstacles, but when I put out the call for people to write to me about what they were going through, no men wrote to me.
No way.
So I didn't have the chance. I mean, I would love it. Everybody is invited into this conversation, and that may be because, certainly after Eat, Pray, Love, I became branded as a chick lit author, so it, probably guys are afraid to enter into that room, although they're very invited. But it may also be because men have trouble talking about their vulnerability and saying, look, I'm having a lot of trouble doing this. I'm stuck. I'm blocked. I'm struggling. You know, I mean, maybe that's just something that culturally men are not allowed to say and that women are allowed to say. So that's the male obstacle, right? I think mm-hmm. the women's obstacle is maybe too much vulnerability mm-hmm. And getting a little bit lost in the maze of insecurity and low self-worth. I think for me, what I witness when I see women who are not doing the creative work that they might be doing is that there is a real central crisis there about the question of belonging, about whether you are indeed allowed to do this. And there's obvious cultural and historical reasons why women might have more difficulty accessing a certain sense of entitlement, because you need entitlement in order to practice creativity. Certainly, women have been getting centuries and millennia of messages saying, you're not really that entitled to be here. Mm-hmm. It's better if you're invisible. You're not allowed to have a voice. And you're not here to create. You're here to procreate. Right? Like, that's your job, that's your biological destiny, and that's what we need from you, and otherwise, please stay out of it. that's certainly the message that all of our ancestors got. Interestingly enough, I'm fascinated by the ways in which women throughout history, despite that message, have been creative. Oftentimes using moments that they steal from their families and materials that nobody else wants. Literally making creativity out of scraps. Right? I mean, that's been a lot of women's art over the centuries, like patchworks and quilts and tiny miniature things and taking objects that nobody else is using and making art out of them. It hasn't stopped women, in other words, your ancestors and mine, from expressing their creativity somehow. I would like to see women have a bigger voice than that now. And for that, you really have to step into a sense of your own belonging and to let go of this idea that anything that you do that brings you to life in a personal way is somehow a selfish act that makes you a bad person. I think that's particularly mm-hmm. difficult for women who are mothers, that they struggle with this idea that any time that they give to themselves is time that they're stealing from the children, and that the children and the family are owed all of their time. That's something we have to push back against as women in a very big way. And the greatest community service that I think that you can offer to the world is to become a fully actualized human being, because you and I know when we're around people like that who are all fired up and alive and happy and joyful, it's a gift to us, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a gift to us to be around somebody like that, because they show us possibilities for our own lives. And so we sort of owe it to each other, I think, to come into being in a much bigger way.
Thank you, Elizabeth Gilbert, and thank you for your new inspirational book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. Good luck on your good luck on your book tour.
Thanks, Leanne. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Congratulations. It's the number one New York Times bestseller this week.
Thank you.
Go.
Wild stuff. Thank you so much, and take very good care.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm Leanne Kranz. Stay tuned for Words and Pictures.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 6th Annual Teaching with Purpose Conference on October 9th and 10th at Park Rose Middle School, located at 11800 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland, Oregon. The Teaching with Purpose Conference provides information, tools, and materials relating to culturally responsive teaching. The conference aims to address legislation relating to culturally responsive education in Oregon and around the country. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present an evening of music and dialogue on the climate and jobs crisis Saturday, October 10th at 6:30 p.m. Joe Uline is a labor leader who will discuss the urgency and the climate crisis and the response that must be made in carbon neutral work, education, and more. Again, that's an evening of music and dialogue on the climate and job crisis Saturday, October 10th, 6:30 p.m. at the AFL-CIO Hall at 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today is cartoonist and globetrotting journalist Ted Rall, whose new book is a graphic biography of NSA whistleblower.